outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place.
Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler and Mike Malott. A little later, Jim Ananick, the Senate Minority Leader, is going to be joining us from his Flint headquarters. But first, before we start talking about lame duck, and we're going to get to lame duck here later in the broadcast, I wanted to talk about debates. Before we get too far removed from the general election, at a certain point, and I think the point's got to be now, the media has to come together and we have to get control of the debates. Because this last debate season for the general election completely got away from the media, and I don't know if it ever really served the public at all. I think it's time for a debate commission. I don't know what you guys think about this, but some kind of debate commission like what we have at the national level for the President of the United States, where we have three debates and the media is controlling the debates as opposed to the candidates controlling the debates. I want to get your thoughts on this. Let's start with you, Jacob.
A couple things here. We've been talking about this in the newsroom, and we asked some pundits, and I think if you ask more people, they would agree that we can at least start with some common ground and that the debates this past session did not serve our purposes well. The candidates, when they aren't asked follow-up questions and you have certain formats, you basically are practicing to perform on a debate, not so much answering questions and people getting to know what they need to know kind of thing. And so we can talk about debate commission, everything like that, but I think the point is there needs to be kind of a rethinking and refocus on how we do debates. And as we were talking right before this, to kind of refocus on how do we come up collectively, media and parties and candidates, kind of come up with a debate that's going to serve the public better.
Because the public wasn't served in these debates, Mike. Would you agree? I mean, the whole purpose we do this is to educate voters, and the voters were not educated when you're talking about the governor debate and the U.S. Senate debate. We had no attorney general debate, which is a travesty. And then the secretary of state debate, I would say, was probably the best of the bunch. The Skubic debate on off the record, if I have any criticism of that, is that it was too short.
And the problem was that often the candidate did not even answer the question, and there was no or little opportunity for follow-up. So if the candidate's not going to answer the question, then that needs to be made clear that you're not going to answer the question. Otherwise, there should be follow-ups. So there has to be something different in the format. If the campaigns get to dictate the format, you're not going to get to those follow-ups. They were trying to avoid the follow-ups. They were trying to avoid saying what they're anything other than their talking points.
And you hit it right there. The candidates are controlling the formats. The candidates are controlling whether we have debates or not. And this isn't about Whitmer and Schuette, because we had the same thing with Rick Snyder and Mark Schauer, and that Rick Snyder refused the debate. They basically had to beg, borrow, and steal to get him to do one debate, which I don't think is right either. Three debates is fine, but the media has to take control of these things. We cannot let the candidates continue to dictate when these debates are going to be, what the format is going to be, where and when these are going to be. Sunday debates, I got to say, are the most ridiculous thing in this entire election. Nobody is dialed in to watching debates on a Sunday. That is absurd. There are sections of the state where you don't even knock on doors on Sundays. On the west side of the state, there's still people go to church two times a day on Sunday. Nobody is focused into debates on Sunday. So to have a debate in the middle of the afternoon and the west side of the state on a Sunday is absolutely ridiculous. Nobody is watching that, Jacob. And that kind of foolishness needs to stop. That U.S. Senate debate on the west side of the state was ridiculous.
But what's a better time, Kyle, to have
Tuesday,
a debate?
Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. Get it during the working week when people are dialed into thinking about public policy or thinking about just kind of general life. Sunday is a day that a lot of people just check out. It's a family day. It's a church day. It's a day to get caught up on stuff outside, to relax, do your yard work, or, you know, spend time with your family, whatever. Nobody's thinking about politics on a Sunday, Jacob. Not your regular family, folks.
Yeah, and so I think those are good points. And I think the question I'd ask you, and I'll jump in this too, is just what can be done to change this? And I think if there's any time the media needs to come together, it's, you know, this time for a number of reasons. But to recognize that a debate is a media event. And so when we talk about kind of taking control of the format and the terms, I think that's very critical in recognizing that this is something that is a media event. It should be driven by the media. And I think we have more than just a right to have a seat at the table. I think we need to be kind of
driving the train.
Yes.
I mean, we need to be driving the train on this, Mike.
Agreed. The problem is you've got all these different reporters, and if you're the only reporter who gets the debate, you're going to take that. So reporters, journalists, TV anchors, they all have to agree that we're not going to take our own debate. That's what's been happening, is
exactly
individual
right.
reporters
right.
have been saying, okay, yes, I will do your debate, and you can set the rules, and I, as a moderator, I will follow your rules to interview you.
Because I want it that bad. And
right.
we can't be selfish on this. Everybody gets a turn, but we can't be selfish and just saying, hey, I'll take whatever gets thrown my way so that I can be the one who's in the front of that. That has to stop. Everybody should be able to get a turn for the benefit of the public. Let's remember why we do these debates. We don't do these for particular TV station egos. We're doing this to educate the public. And those gubernatorial debates, particularly the second one, nobody was educated. I think that I think the general, I mean, nobody was educated on that. It was almost a waste of time. I mean, if we wanted to hear their talking points, we can just go on their website and hear their talking points. Why are we even having them? We got Facebook now. They could have put that on Facebook. And if you really wanted to hear their plan on education, on the roads, on environment or whatever, you can go to their website and find them out. Well, except for Schuette, I don't know if he really had any positions on anything except for a paycheck agenda. But the point is that we didn't really find out anything with these debates, Jacob.
Yeah, and just to go back on that point, I think the format of debates is hurting the candidates because they're practicing to perform on a debate. They're not practicing to be a well-rounded public official who can explain why they believe what they want to do. And I think that's a very critical piece. And so going back to what the media should do, besides kind of not, the other thing that we kind of need to be sacrificial about is when we dictate these terms, to be not be afraid to say, to go to the parties, go to the candidates and say, these are the terms, and being willing that if they're not going to do it, that we have to kind of, you know, leave it at that. Because I think what I see here is that TV stations or media outlets are willing to take whatever under the system.
They are.
And so not only do we not need to just take whatever is given our way, but if we kind of reassert some more control in this, we have to be willing to kind to not settle, but to set the terms that we believe are going to provide the most productive dialogue possible.
And the most productive dialogue is a reporter who's being able to ask some questions. We can have some back and forth between candidates. Because what's happening right now is that campaigns are cherry picking where they want these debates. So they're going to go in the area where they think that they can dictate the schedule and they can dictate the terms of everything. And you notice that Tim Skubick didn't get a gubernatorial debate. That wasn't an accident. That was one of the candidates did not want to be confronted with Tim Skubick and have to answer tough questions. And that's not the way that it should be. The media is the one who is performing this service. This is our product, and we should have control over our product. We shouldn't sacrifice that out to somebody else. Let somebody else dictate what our product should look like. This is our product. I don't know why we're letting someone else tell us what we should be putting on our television sets. The broadcasters are the ones who have control over this, not the candidates. So this is high time where we need the broadcasters to step up, actually create a debate commission and make it happen for the benefit of everybody, for the benefit of the universe of broadcasters in general, for the media in general, and for the public in general. Most importantly, for the viewing public, we need to have a real debate commission and a real debate schedule. For crying out loud, let's make it happen, and so we can get done with these garbage debates that we had this last section. I'll say it, garbage debates. They stunk. All right. Can I calm down now? Jake, calm me down.
Hear, hear. Well, this is, I think it first takes all of us as the media have collectively allowed this to happen. And so I think we need to admit that and recognize that this is a potential rallying call for us and for the rest of the media, broadcast, print, online in general, And that recognizing to admit that we've allowed this to happen and that we need to kind of come together. And also just recognizing that I think this has happened because the media, we're so busy doing our jobs that we don't have the time to step back and think about how can we advocate for ourselves in a better way where we're thinking about the collective whole. And so I don't think anyone else is going to do it for us. And so I think that's why we need to come together on this.
Okay, we're going to turn the page quickly and just talk about lame duck. We're going to have the next few podcasts to talk more about lame duck. But I just want to say in general, probably the most important thing that happened last week is that the governor put out this proposed supplemental. And what this does is, I think, guarantees us a long lame duck. We have $370 million in free money, basically, that the governor's just kind of thrown out there. And whenever there's free money around Christmas time, the Christmas tree that is developed is larger than the one in front of the state capitol. He's got leverage like you would not believe right now, because he can line item veto anything in that, and he can get votes, he can cut deals. And if he's got that kind of leverage, and he really wants this tipping fee increase, and maybe he's even going to push for the water tax, watch out, guys. This could be a real long one.
Well, I think that's a very interesting point. Looking at it from that perspective, I think there's already kind of a long laundry list that this covers. You know, it's not kind of just divided up into four or five things. I mean, if you look at our story of the breakdown that kind of summarizes what I saw, was a very long document. I mean, we're covering everything, all the issues that have kind of cropped up recently, CPS workers, the Line 5 tunnel thing. And then, of course, where the conflict is going to be is the governor's investment priorities are going to be different than the 150, 140 lawmakers' right. priorities. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be interesting. It's going to be interesting to see where the supplemental interplays with some of the other legislative priorities that are out there.
And Mike, when our preview that we did for MERS, I listed 20 items that are going to go, aren't going to go, could go. And then we've got, of course, the big items, which is changing the ballot proposals that are very likely going to go, and the supplemental. I mean, there's a lot of items. And then there's, so that's like 21. There's several more out there that we haven't even talked about or even thought of yet.
Right. There's a ton of issues. And the key factor here is any issue that Snyder would sign that Whitmer wouldn't.
Yes, that's
the issue. So they have to cherry pick what issues they send off to the governor's desk.
This is the last gasp. I mean, basically for 4 years and maybe 8 years, and maybe even just 2 years. I mean, maybe the House changes over. We don't know. This is their last chance. So if there's something that they don't think that Whitmer's going to sign, they got to get it done now.
Right. And Line 5, I think, is the perfect example of this. They have to get it locked in place. Whatever they want for Line 5 has to be locked in place. And how do you do that? Because the next legislature could turn around and change it all anyway.
They could, but, I mean, this legislature isn't going to be that much different from the next one.
That's true. But whatever they want, it has to be signed by Snyder, because Whitmer wouldn't sign the same things.
Yeah, that's
right.
I mean,
she's already said that she'll try to get that line out of there.
A lot of things that are kind of no man's land as far as what's going to happen. School safety legislation, more on the Larry Nassar situation. Will that additional House bills, will those get moving? Is there some kind of agreement that can happen there? Civil asset forfeiture. I mean, there's all sorts of these kind of bigger issues out there. A through F grading scale. A lot of issues that are almost kind of there, but not quite there. And those are the ones you got to look at lame duck, not brand new ideas. Brand new ideas never get anywhere in lame duck. They got to be far along in the process and almost there. They just kind of need those last couple tweaks, and then they go. And there's a lot of them, guys. All right, so let's find out what's on the top of the Senate Minority Leader's list, Jim Ananick, right now.
And my dear, we're still goodbye. But as long as you'd love me so, let it snow and snow.
Joining us on the other end of the line is the Senate Minority Leader. He is Jim Ananick. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having us.
So we know what the Republicans want to do in lame duck. They want to change the minimum wage and the paid sick leave ballot proposals. What is top on your list? If you could pass something in lame duck, what would you pass?
Whew, man, that's a good question. We'll be more than happy to sit down and work with Republicans on finding they count paid sick days and, you know, minimum wage if they're serious about it. But it seems like they have an agenda that they had a long time ago, because when we were debating it on the floor, I saw a lot of the business groups and the restaurant association folks, and they seem like they already had a plan, not just to pass it, but they already had the plan in place to replace it. So it doesn't seem like they're really open to those kind of conversations. But, I mean, well, I think Kevin Hertel has been working diligently with Chairman Graves on the remainder portion of the unemployment fix. People were wronged by this government, which happens a lot under Governor Schneider. But in this case, the unemployment fix, I think we need to make sure that we put the resources aside to make sure that we get people that were harmed, you know, fall down the money that they deserve. So I'd say that'd be number one. There's been a long push, some of those Nassar bills that still haven't got across the finish line. I mean, I think a lot of people got the press win they wanted, and we saw that during the campaign with some of the folks, you know, using that ad for their political advantage, none of which actually won. But I think people don't really like that type of exploiting people for their own political gain. But I think those bills still need to get finished. And I think if we don't do them, then all the rhetoric we talked about in early June was empty, you know, because if we don't actually get something across the finish line, then I think shame on us. Those are the big things I think I'd want to see us get worked on. But there's also a lot of priorities that not of a, you know, two of us coming back to the Senate next term. And so I have a number of colleagues that have priorities they've been working on for a long time. And I like to work with Majority Leader Mikoff and Tom Leonard and the governor to try to get those done. So,
now, one of the
one
of the things that you've wanted to get done is some type of response legislation to the Flint water crisis. Are you happy with what you've seen so far out of the Flint water task force, or is there something that we can still do in lame duck on that?
Yeah, there's still a lot of things we could do. I think we should do, and you know, Joe Hune in particular, and Jim Stamos as well. We came up with some pretty good recommendations, I think, out of the joint committee. Obviously, the governor's task force came up with a bunch of recommendations, Civil Rights Commission, just a bunch of people. But there's a lot of things that still left to be done on lead and water, but also PFAS. So, I mean, I think I'm not overly optimistic about that. I think it should be a relatively easy lift. But for whatever reason, you know, helping people, protecting people is not seem to be on the agenda right now. So I'll start again in the fall. I'll start again in January with a new legislature and, you know, new governor, and hopefully we can actually get serious about addressing these issues. Because I don't understand a lot of the recommendations and bill requests we put in were bipartisan, that they're not overly burdensome. They're just protecting people. And why we haven't moved on them is beyond me, but we'll see. So, I mean, I'm still going to push for them, but I'm not holding out a lot of hope, unfortunately.
One of the things that you guys are going to be faced with is this large supplemental request that Governor Snyder's put out there, $371 million. Now, the most significant part of this is $183 million that came in more than expected, a lot of it from this new online sales tax legislation that, or this court decision that came in. Now, as it stands right now, sales tax revenue is cut up, is earmarked in a specific way, where 70% of it basically goes to the schools, 10% of it goes to local governments, and only like 15% goes to the general fund. But the governor is asking that the legislature change the formula when it comes to this excess new online sales tax money so that it all goes to roads. What do you think of that?
You know, I think in the short term, putting extra money towards roads is not a bad thing. I mean, I think it highlights the failed roads plan that they did a few years ago and the need for a serious push coming forward, you know, in January to have a real serious infrastructure plan. It's one of the many failings that Governor Snyder's going to have to look back on over the last, over his 8 years, and realize that it was just another thing that he didn't get done that he said he was going to get done. So I think going forward, I think that should be something that we decide, you know, with the new legislature, the new governor. But in the short term, I don't see a problem with putting more money towards the roads. But let's be real. This supplemental is a start of where it's at. They're going to put so much into there to try to pass, because the governor's going to trade anything for his tipping fees bills. That's what he wants part of his legacy to be. And I think that you're going to see that supplemental just soar when it comes to adding things in and taking things out, depending on if people are willing to vote for tipping fees. And I think you know, I think it's unfortunate that, you know, the governor's unwilling to say whether or not he'll veto some of this really right-wing stuff that's being proposed in lame duck. And if he's willing to sign it for tipping fees, then all of this talk about, you know, civility and I'm a different kind of governor, it's just all bullshit, and excuse my language. It's just, that's what his legacy will be, that he's just, he'll be the most right-wing governor we've ever had, because it doesn't matter what you say, it matters what you sign.
Mm-hmm.
And if he signs a bunch of garbage that the public doesn't want, the public to send a strong message in November for, then he's just like every other politician, and he's not this person he says he is. And I think that's the most important thing to highlight. It's not even relevant about whether we, it's a good question you're asking me, Kyle, but I think the most important thing is to notice that this is nothing more than a gimmick to try to get people to vote for tipping fees. And anybody foolish enough to fall for it, you know, should have their head examined, because especially any Democrat. I mean, I think, you know, obviously at some point in time, tipping fees should be on the table to be discussed, but if they're going to pass a bunch of things and he's going to sign it, I don't know why any Democrat with any sort of IQ at all, whatever, consider voting for tipping fees. Because I don't know why we'd help them pass a bunch of right-wing things that the voters just said we don't want anymore of. I mean, they sent a pretty strong message in November that this kind of games where we just pass a bunch of horrible things after everybody's held accountable, I think flies in exactly the face of what the voters just said they wanted.
Well, let's talk about that, because tipping fees, the raise in the tipping fee is supposed to go toward cleaning these Superfund sites or these brown fields, these toxic sites that need cleanup. There's currently no revenue stream coming from them. It would seem like you might be sympathetic toward this, because raising the tipping fee means helping the environment.
Yeah, I think on a surface, if you look at it aside from all the other things, but that's not the way life works, right? I mean, you have to look at everything that's around it. I mean, they still have a bill out there to basically have the fox watch the hen house. They still want to gut regulations. They still want to do no stricter than federal. So why would we tax citizens more to pay for pollution created by the very people that they want to let pollute more? So what they're saying is, we're going to let more people pollute. We'll hold people less accountable. The folks that we know did it, like some of these PFAS sites. I mean, it's no guessing game who did it. We know exactly who did it. Mm-hmm. We're going to say, you don't have to pay for anything. We're going to make people pay more to fix this issue. Now, look, we need a revenue source. There's no question about it. But it's at least twofold, right? You have to stop the pollution from happening. You have to hold people accountable who did it. And then you can have a stream of revenue to fix it. But if you don't actually do the first part, all you're saying is, yeah, keep polluting. Don't worry about it. We'll make these suckers, the Michigan taxpayers, pay for it.
Okay.
And anybody who, I mean, I think until we have a serious conversation about all the environmental regulations they're going to want to pass, or I should say deregulating in lame duck, why would we want to give a revenue stream to help fix it? Like, I think having a revenue stream and figuring out a way to pay for it is a legitimate conversation to have. We obviously have to do that. But I think if you're going to also at the same time say, I'll keep polluting, we're not going to hold you accountable, don't worry about it, I just don't see how you can justify that. So I think it's too important of a question to say, okay, well, we'll just vote for it and trust you to not sign some of these bills. I just don't see a point in that. I mean, I really think we're actually enabling someone's other legislation to get passed and signed if we agree to vote for something way too early.
Okay.
I'm not saying it should be off the table completely, but there's all these things that the Michigan public do not want to see passed, and that flies in the face of cleaning up the environment. I mean, if we're going to hurt the environment while we're cleaning it up, it seems to defeat the purpose. So I think it's an important question to have on the table. I think we should never say never, but anybody who signs off on it before we get assurances of those things aren't going to happen, it just doesn't make sense.
Now, what about this water tax that he's also proposing, this $5 a head water tax to clean the to fix the underground infrastructure? Is that too heavy of a lift for lame duck at the same time as the tipping fees?
I think from what I'm hearing from everybody, that's dead on arrival. That was never really it never really got any traction at all. So I don't, you know, I think we obviously have to do it. Somebody who lives in Flint, where the state government, through their, you know, incompetence and the emergency manager's actions, basically destroyed the pipes in our community, I think we obviously have to have a source. And obviously we have federal revenues and some state money to cover that specifically in Flint. But we have to deal with it statewide. It's going to be a problem. So I think having some mechanism to pay for that is important. But, you know, I'm hearing nothing coming out of my colleagues in either chamber that have any interest in moving it. So I'm assuming that's going to be something we're going to have to address next term, and I'm fine with that too. I mean, I've never been a big fan of lame duck in the first place. I mean, I think, you know, a bunch of people that have no accountability to the voters, especially with the type of term limits we have in Michigan, it just doesn't seem right to be doing all this stuff when no one can hold us accountable again. I mean, I'm not running for office again, right? I mean, Curtis isn't running for office again. A bunch of my colleagues in the Senate aren't running for office. They're either termed out or they ran for their last term. To have us vote on a bunch of things that we didn't have the courage to vote for before the election just doesn't seem right. So, I mean, I don't think the water fee is even going to come up. I really don't. I mean, it's legitimate to talk about that, but I mean, it's a legitimate issue, but I'm just hearing absolutely nothing. Seems like they're willing to maybe do tipping fees or at least entertain the idea, but the water fee seems to be going nowhere.
Now, the last thing I wanted to ask you about, obviously, this is going to be the last few weeks that Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff will be in office, and then we'll have Mike Shirkey in the next session. Just having worked with both gentlemen, what do you think the big difference is going to be? What are we going to see from Senator Shirkey that maybe we didn't see from Meekhoff or I guess, vice versa?
Yeah, and it's not a secret, right? I'm close to both of them. Both, I'm personal friends with both of them outside of the job. I don't always agree with them, of course, but I've got great relationships with both of them. I think the difference for me will be that we're going to have more members with next term, and we're going to have a Democratic governor. So I think you'll see Mike, who's a very principled person. You know, he's got strong beliefs, but I also think he wants to get things done. So I think you'll see Mike willing to compromise, willing to find common ground where Arlen didn't really have to do that. Arlen and I worked together on a few things, but it wasn't like he had to do that. It was just we could find agreement on things and get it done, where it's going to be a little bit different dynamic next term. So, you know, Arlen had 27 members, and at a point in time we had 10. There just wasn't, we were a lot more relevant than a 10-member caucus should be. But, you know, I think part of it will be it's just the dynamics of Lansing. You know, I think that's going to change. I think they're both. I think Arlen, as much as I didn't always agree with the decisions he made, he was a strong leader. He when he wanted to get something done, he got it done. And I think that's important to note. I didn't always agree with it, and I, you know, would fight it on the floor. But and I think Mike is another person who has also got a good understanding of his caucus. You know, I think him and I will be in regular communication. So, I mean, I think the thing, the biggest change would be the fact that the dynamics changed, and that if we want to get things done, which I think all of us do, is we're going to have to find common ground as opposed to just trying to ram stuff through on a party line vote. And I think that's actually going to be good for Michigan. I think it's actually good for us to sit down and have to discuss things. And right now, the majority leader can just talk to the governor, and the governor can just talk to the speaker, and they can come up with some sort of agreement. Next term, it's going to have to be all of us talking. And I think it'll lead to better government. That's what I'm hoping, at least.
And Senate Minority Leader Jim Ananick, looks like we have 4 weeks of lame duck, possibly, and the last day could be December 20. What do you think the odds are that that happens, that we go all the way to the 20th of December?
Well, I will probably this week ask people when their vacation plans are. I mean, my wife teaches. I ain't going anywhere. So it doesn't matter to me. We can work whenever they want to, as long as they want to work. But I'll get a feel for people when they have airplanes. So we will see. I'd be really happy to chip in to buy something for Arlen if he wanted to leave a week or two early.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you can do some parasailing, or maybe we'll pay for that scuba diving trip you might want to do.
Whatever it takes to get people out of town, I'm more than happy to do it.
Jim Ananick, Senate Minority Leader, thanks for taking time on the podcast today.
Thanks a lot, pal. I appreciate it.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Senator Ananick. Wish John well. Jacob and Mike, I'm almost wondering if the UP people have already started their commute on their snowmobiles. Wouldn't that be sweet to see them, like, just pull up here on the snowmobile?
If I remember correctly, I think they've already had a snowfall, so I think they're good to go.
I wonder if you can take a snowmobile over the Mackinac Bridge. Because I'm sure, you know, the straits aren't frozen yet, so you can't go over the straits yet with them. So could you do that?
I think you got to put it on a trailer and drive it across. I don't think you can ride it straight
straight over the bridge.
If you could, it should cost less in tolls than your... There's less axles on that.
Yeah, there's no axles on there.
Maybe they'll be on the Bridge Authority agenda next to the Line 5 tunnel agreement.
Where would you park the snowmobile if you were to drive it up here?
Oh, anywhere.
Would you just park it right on the lawn?
It's like a bike, right? Put it right next to those scooters.
Next to your bird scooter.
Yeah, you're allowed to park those anywhere, so I guess that should just apply to everything.
Just ditch it out in front of MERS, right? Like Mike did the other day.
Yeah, our company scooter is gone, unfortunately. It was laying out there for a while, and I don't think it's there anymore.
Well, I hope Bird and Lime picked up their scooters, because I don't think anybody's going to be scooting around anytime.
I hope Bird and Lime are coming out with the winter models here pretty soon with the snow tires. I just downloaded the apps. I just got put my credit card info on. I'm ready to take these on a test drive after having a lot of curiosity.
There's an idea for a new business. Instead of rental scooters, rental snowmobiles.
There you go.
And that makes it year-round.
See, now I would get on a rental snowmobile to go down the Capitol. That would be fun. I wasn't going to do a scooter, but I'll do a snowmobile.
There you go.
All right. Well, we just gave you an idea, Lyman Bird. Snowmobiles here in the Capitol. We'll use them. That'll be fun. I don't know if we can ride them on sidewalks. Probably not.
No. Well, if you can ride them, yeah. If you're going to ride them on Mackinac Bridge, that's regular vehicle traffic there. Yeah,
okay. Put a plate on them. All right. That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Podcast. For Mike and Jacob, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, thank you, AT&T, for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
Let it snow.